coming up next on This Week in Computer Hardware. Small power supplies are awesome. In Telepark Mayhem, Linux gets Steam $6,000 for a gaming PC and why you should add Thunderbolt now, not later. All that and more coming up next on Twitch.
Netcasts you love.
From people you trust.
This is Twit.
Bandwidth for Twitch is provided by CacheFly at CacheFly.com.
This is Twitch, This Week in Computer Hardware, episode 194, recorded on November 8th, 2012. Your $6,000 Linux PC can run Steam.
This episode of This Week in Computer Hardware is brought to you by Lantronix, maker of the XPrint server. Print from your iPad, iPhone, or any iOS device to virtually any printer. For more information, visit xprintserver.com/twit and enter the coupon code TWIT to receive free shipping on your order.
Welcome to Twitch, This Week in Computer Hardware. I'm your host, Patrick Norton, and this is the show on Twit where we try to bring you the most exciting and important news in computer hardware. We love the tablets, and of course, we're going to answer a bunch of your viewer questions later on in the show. Joining me, as always, Mr. Ryan Shrout from PCPer.com. Ryan, how are you tonight?
I'm doing okay. I'm doing well. Ready to go home and pack up and go on a little trip. But I'm ready to take a couple of day vacation, that's for sure.
I can tell you already, you're actually like heading to New York because like you're like, yeah, I'm doing good. Going to the city.
I've already got the accent in. Nice.
So you're going to follow your beloved basketball team there.
I am. Yeah. My wife and I kind of usually every other year we find a good away trip to go on with them and use it as our excuse to go away from family and friends for a little while.
Yeah, be interesting to see whether or not like, you know, you said you still haven't checked to make sure you have a hotel room, right?
Well, that's true. I figured surely they would contact people if they didn't have rooms.
How did they call you if all the phones got washed away?
So I'm just gonna show up. I'm gonna go to the airport here in Cincinnati and hope there's still a plane going because, you know, with all the snow crap that should still happen. Game's not till late tomorrow. It should be good. We got tickets to go see Spider-Man on Broadway. So, yeah, we'll do some fun stuff.
That'd be exciting. New York's always fun. Plus, the food is epic.
Yes.
Gotta say, 24-hour Korean. Korean at 4 in the morning, right after the bars close. Epic. Twit.tv/Twitch. If you're not familiar with the podcast, well, you can find all of them at twit.tv/Twitch. We'd love you to subscribe, but we should fire up the news. If you perchance have a spare used car you want to sell or $5,500 in cash, you can score yourself the Origin Genesis overclocked quad SLI gaming rig. We're talking about dual GTX 690s, all the heat you could possibly want in one PC case, and probably a healthy excuse for a 1,000 or 1,200 watt power supply. Dude, $5,500 is a lot of money. Excuse me, $5,750.
Yeah, get it right. All right. I mean, if we're gonna quote the price, let's make sure we get every dollar in there.
What about the tax? What about shipping? What about the insurance on this thing?
I hope they ship it for free. I don't know if that's the case, but it feels like in a purchase that should be shipped for free. But I don't know. Taxes. I love this case. Check your state.
Corsair 800D chassis, Core i7-3930K, 6-core Sandy Bridge E running at 4.9 gigahertz, Intel's GX79SR motherboard, dual NVIDIA GeForce GTX 690 4-gig cards, quad SLI, baby, 16 gigs DDR3, 1866 quad-channel memory, a 1,200-watt Corsair AX1200i power supply, and this is a situation where a 1,200-watt power supply is appropriate. Dual 120 gigabyte Corsair Force GT SSDs and RAID 0, 1 terabyte Seagate 7200 RPM SATA 6G hard disk drive, and the custom Origin cryogenic liquid cooling setup. Okay. And it's shipped in its own packing. The packing case may be the best part of the entire thing. I don't know.
Yeah, I really do. Like when UPS brings you that, you feel like a badass. Like, oh yeah, I got crate shipped to me. Sure. Yeah.
You know, there's like inflated air packaging stuffed inside the case to help secure everything. What's actually going on with the cryogenic cooling? Is it actual cryogenic? Is it actually like frozen water, or is this merely a fancy name for water cooling?
the second one. It's their branding for it. The idea behind the cryogenic cooling is it's kind of their brand name for the program that they're able to, depending on the customer's request, basically liquid cool anything. In this system, the graphics cards are not liquid cooled, but that is an option. You could also, they have dual processor systems they can use liquid cooling on. You get to choose the color of the tubing, the size of the tubing. You can get pretty detailed on what you want to specify for a water cooling setup. They also allow you to say, again, this is somebody who's buying a $5,700 computer. If you want to ship it back and have them upgrade the graphics cards a year or two down the line and say, oh, yeah, you know what? Can we go ahead and throw that water cooling on those too? Like it's supposed to be, it's not a self-contained water cooling system. It's all kind of like going back to the, I don't want to use the term old school, but it's kind of like old school now.
The word
original water cooling. Yeah.
I mean, the idea that somebody sort of manually assembles a system, you know, this is like what most of the boutique vendors used to be before they got bought up by major PC vendors. But
right.
this is seriously handcrafted one by one, healthily priced. I mean, do you feel like, you know, could you have assembled something like this for $4,000? I mean, is there an honest, you know, $6,000 in value here?
There's not $6,000 worth of hardware. Let me look at the last page because I kind of got as close as I could without knowing the specifics of the water cooling costs because I didn't have access to all those different components.
I can totally see $1,000 in water cooling.
Yeah, I think I had about $4,400 in parts. And I said to add $400 or $500 for liquid cooling components and LED lighting, taking the total to about $4,700, $4,800. So you're paying an $800, $900 markup for the build out, right? And what do you get for that? You know, you get the whole idea of support and warranty. They've pre-overclocked it. A 4.9 gigahertz overclock on all of the cores all of the time is actually really, really high. It's probably the fastest we've ever seen here at PC Perspective, right? So that's pretty good. You're paying for a little bit of the caveats or the doing better than the other guys there. But it is, I mean, the video cards are $1,000 or $1,100 a piece. There's a lot of hardware cost in this. It's, don't get me wrong, this is not a system for very many people. But, you know, if there are people that were like me and you that built their own systems and they were into PC gaming, but unlike us, they got really rich and they want somebody else to do all that stuff for them. So now if they say, this, you know what, I want to be able to play Far Cry 3 when it comes out, I'll buy this.
Well, one, I don't know if they're bin sorting the chips or if their water cooling is so efficient that it's making it easy to get to 4.9 gigahertz, which I think that's all pretty awesome. I will say there is one small piece of disappointment as you scroll down the pictures on the second page, as you look at the cable routing on the back of the system. That's like my one complaint about it. You know what I mean? Like if I'm going to drop, you know, $5,500, $6,000 on a system, I want to see meticulously laid out cables. I want to see art. I want to see macrame back there. Even if I'm never going to take that panel off, I want to know that someday, should my children who inherit this computer after my passing, when they take it apart because they have nothing better to do because it's a giant paperweight because we're all, you know, using nano computers, I want to see brilliant cable layout. And that is not a brilliant cable layout. The rest of the machine... is immaculate, but the cable layout was a little atrocious for the money.
Its performance is great, obviously, as you would expect. 4.9 gigahertz, 6-core part is about the fastest thing you can buy in a single CPU, and it probably is the fastest thing you can buy in a single socket platform. And then, obviously, graphics-wise, using 4 Kepler GK104 GPUs in a system works pretty well, as it turns out. Yeah, I mean, even if you're stupid rich and you're like, I'm going to buy a computer, don't buy something like this unless you're going to use triple monitors or something like that, right? Because if you buy this and you hook it up to a single 30-inch panel is like, yeah, that's really kind of a waste.
You should be rocking 3 30-inch or 27-inch high-resolution panels. Ryan Trout will individually travel to your home to slap you. If you're running a single 1080p monitor.
Yeah, but they have to pay for it because they're the rich ones.
And moving on, AMD launches the Pile Driver-based Opteron 6300 server chips. So Monday, basically the Pile Driver architecture using the Trinity APUs and the Vishir desktop CPUs. AMD is launching their server optimized version of that, aka the Opteron. So what's going on with these compared to the 6200s? Obviously, it's a step above the Bulldozer architecture. Can you drop them into existing servers? Is that kind of what AMD is suggesting is a possibility?
Yeah, pending a BIOS update and verification from your motherboard vendor or your system vendor, whatever it is. Yes, these are the same sockets. Like the 8 and 6 core versions will go into a C32 socket, and then the 16 core version, which if you go to the last picture on that story, gives you like an idea. Like the processor is enormous. There's two physical chips on there, but it's. That will fit into, I think it was a G34 socket. So yeah, these are kind of upgradable parts. If you already have a big infrastructure of Opteron-based servers or workstations, these will be performance bumps for that. It's not super dramatic though. That's what I think is important to take away from this. We've tested Vishera, we've tested Piledriver versus Bulldozer. There are some performance benefits. There's not a huge amount. There's also not a huge amount of power efficiency improvements. There are some, but not a lot. If you take a look at this, TDP ratings go from 85 watts up to 140 watts, and prices from $500 to $1,400, of course. But 140 watt part is still a lot.
Yeah,
you're getting 16 cores, but that's it's what you were kind of getting before.
Yeah, I was gonna say this is like, and I hate to dogpile on dogpile on AMD, but this seems like a really classic story from AMD. We've got a really awesome upgrade path for you. It's gonna blow the it's gonna improve. If you spend more money with us, we'll give you slightly better performance. It's just frustrating. Like, I mean, I don't know if this is like an announcement. Would this bother me as much if the desktop processors were feeling more competitive with Intel? But it's okay. It's an option that's out there. If you need more CPU to throw at your, massive corporate servers, this is an option. Any idea how successful Opteron is, like in terms of total market penetration versus Intel servers and Blade servers and everything else that's out
there? It used to be a lot better. It's been a losing battle for them, and it's the exact same reason why they've lost on the desktop side too. Intel caught up in performance and efficiency. Now, tends to like the buying cycles in enterprise markets tend to be significantly longer than consumer markets, or at least they're stretched out quite a bit. So AMD still has a sizable market share, but it's shrinking. Right, and they're trying desperately to get some of that back. Opteron used to be their biggest profit center, right? When their first Opteron brand came out, when Athlon 64 was a big deal, they started just taking away from the highly profitable, high margin server and enterprise markets. But they have kind of slowly fallen off there. They used to have the fastest performing part, and now they focus on performance per watt. It's the exact same thing you see on the desktop side. They used to have the fastest, and now they're trying to focus on, hey, look at what we can do for the dollar, performance per dollar. So both on the server side and on the desktop side, it's not really that different, right? So the only, offering a 16-core part allows you to do different things in the enterprise market. Now you can have 16 VMs on a single server and not have to use any complicated hypervisors and stuff like that. But it's nothing revolutionary is going to change the company, I guess, out of that release.
Silverstone ST45SF-G, a lowly, and I say this with love and affection, 450 watt power supply. Because usually we're talking about like 1,000 watt I'm searing power supplies of doom. But this is interesting because it's the SFX form factor. What's the difference between that and sort of a regular ATX power supply?
I had actually, before editing this review for Lee, I'm sure I'd heard of it, but I'd never really kind of like grasped my head around it. But the SFX power form factor, or the SFX form factor, is basically one that's frequently found in chassis for home theater PCs and small form factor devices. It's basically taking a power supply with the power plug here and the internal connectors here and just squishing it, right? And it obviously that limits what the components you can put inside, and so it limits the wattage you can get. So the a 450 watt part that's 80 plus gold is actually pretty high quality, high power out of that. I mean, 450 watts is enough to power an Ivy Bridge system with a pretty, you know, impressive discrete card if you want to do that, or you know, it's way overkill for something like a Trinity based system or an Ivy Bridge system with no discrete graphics, right? It's just small power supplies. We actually have a smaller review coming up maybe next week, like a 260 watt power supply. That's compelling, right? 260 watt, and I think it's supposed to be like super efficient at that, you know, the entire range all the way across it.
Well, that would be good, because at that point, 260 watts is getting seriously close to like a 1 amp, 1.5 amp notebook power supply, which should be like 90% plus efficient. It's kind of funny because you start like scaling the numbers down. It's like, okay, volts times amps equals watts. It's like, oh, wow, you know, sub 200 watts, you're basically looking at a relatively efficient notebook power supply for, you know, a Core i5. Or
if when I've gotten like the dual GPU Alienware laptops, those tend to have those giant bricks of power supplies.
Those terrible gaming machines of Doom. I gotta back off from trying to keep up with the chat room. It's been interesting. Also, just looking at the idea of how the truth is that the vast majority of people out there with a single GPU also are well served by a 550 or on the outside 750 watt power supply, like, you know, 850 watts and above is total overkill.
Absolutely. You know, we had a perfect example of that 2 weeks ago when I built, we built a Windows 8 system, and I was building it for my machine, and that's the one that we've integrated in our production systems. And I was using a Micro ATX ASUS P8Z77M Pro motherboard. It's actually a Core i5-3350P processor, which is actually an Ivy Bridge with no integrated graphics on it, or disabled integrated graphics. And then I used like a 660 Ti. But then I just kind of used what extra components we have sitting around. So one of the extra components we had was a Corsair HX 1050 watt power supply. And I thought, wow, this is double what I need in reality. You know, I could get away with a 600 watt and be really safe. But I don't like we have one 600 watt or one 650 that we need to use for other systems. This is way overkill. Well, I guess I'll just go ahead and use it, that type of thing. And I don't want consumers to do that. It is a waste of their money that they can invest in solid state drive or better graphics card or something like that. So that's why, you know, these reviews, like, go take a look at the Silverstone, look at Lee's testing and see, you know, can this run at its 450 watt load completely stable for an extended period of time? That's the kind of stuff that we look at. And then look, your video card only requires a 450 watt power supply. Boom, you're ready to go.
Yeah. I mean, and that's a, you know, something we can't say enough is a quality power supply that delivers the voltage it's supposed to and keeps it steady within specs. There's a lot of weird, untraceable computer problems that involve glitching memory on a hard drive or just having other issues that are solved by going, you know, if you have a $45 case and a power supply came with it, you can probably do a lot better on your power supply, and it might solve some of the problems you're having with your PC.
I'm excited. I got to say it. There is a Linux Steam client beta beginning with 26 games and, quote, big picture mode. So Steam, should you be living under a rock or just anti-gaming? Obviously, the center of online gaming for PC users. But it's interesting, you know, to put that into context, is that 60,000 applications, 6,000 applications for the beta build.
There's 60,000 on games? The Windows version.
Ah, there we go.
Okay, there's 60,000 applications and games on Windows beta, and there's a small subset of that for the Linux beta.
That was I wasn't sure if that was people Linux users applying for the beta, or if it was 60,000 apps running on Steam versus 26 Linux apps.
gotcha. No, I think I might have had that backwards too. Okay, makes sense.
Let's see, 26 divided by 60,000. That's going to be a really funny number.
Yeah, I don't know. No, I think, you might have been right. I think it might have been 60,000 apps into the beta. I think I think that might be it. Users who wanted the beta. I know. All I know is I did not get in. I applied for this because I desperately wanted to. I thought it would be a really cool story to, you know, build kind of a low cost machine. You know, low cost Ivy Bridge, low cost NVIDIA or AMD graphics card, and then say, okay, people always had to build a Windows machine to play games. Okay, well, here's Steam just launched. Let's try it. What's the experience like? What's the driver installation process like? Because I think there are a lot of people out there, Windows and Mac users alike, that would be willing to give Linux a shot, but they're just very comfortable with where, you know, they're at. We understand Windows. We understand Mac, whatever it is. To many people, and including me, the idea of, okay, go update your Linux graphics driver. I go, I'm not 100% sure how to do that, right? And installing games and all that kind of stuff, not exactly sure how you're going to do that necessarily. But with Steam, you apply this level of understanding, this method of installation and use cases and interaction with these applications. And in theory, it should just work. I mean, the list of games isn't that great, but...
Well, you got to start somewhere, right?
Yeah. I mean, you do. Go ahead.
Oh, I was going to say, I'm really curious because, you know, it's you look at this and it's like, you know, you're not really seeing any major game. I'm going to say, you know, Team Fortress 2, right, is
that's
one
it.
Of the more higher profile games on this.
Yeah, and I wonder, that can't be overlooked because that is probably still one of the most popular played games on Windows. Mm-hmm. And in terms of light on hardware, and it's also one of Valve's kind of signature brands. So if it's successful, you foresee them bringing in their other brands like Left 4 Dead and Half-Life and that kind of stuff.
Have they talked about whether, I mean, I assume they're running this in emulation, like in some sort of super version of Wine. Have they talked too much about how?
No.
Okay.
I have no idea. I honestly have no clue. I was actually under the understanding, well, I guess I don't know. I would have assumed that these are recreations of it, but it could be that they are using some complicated, or not complicated, but some maybe more in-depth, verified, tested, QA'd emulation system for it. I don't know. I haven't read anywhere if they've talked about that. I know Scott, who's in the chat room, who writes at PC Per, might know that kind of stuff. But... yeah, I'm not sure.
Interesting.
Still interesting.
Be something for us. I also got to say the big picture mode, the new interface they're playing around with Steam is really interesting to look at.
Yep.
It's very pretty. Also, it's really funny. If you go to steamcommunity.com/Linux, you can see people arguing about how, like, you know, in Ubuntu only beta is a bad idea.
Even amongst Linux fans, there's infighting. Yes.
We could always argue about distros. So cruel. New NVIDIA drivers, man. What's the story on them? Are we seeing a performance boost? Are we having new exciting features?
Well, I don't. I haven't tested this. This is because this is a Linux driver release. The reason I put this in here is I just thought it was, you know, saw these stories kind of back to back, and I thought, okay, this is what if you're a Linux fan, if you're a fan of open source, this is what you want to see. You want to see people paying attention to it. Steam, huge thing. Frequent driver releases, even though NVIDIA gets a pretty negative rap, pretty bad rap in the Linux community for not open sourcing their drivers. Frequent releases, performance increases, being able to try to match performance of gaming in Windows is going to be important for that. So, you know, I linked to this story here at Phoronix about the R310 Linux driver improvements, and it looks like in some games, you know, there were Unigine has a Linux version. I assume if anybody was going to have access to Steam performance numbers, it would be these guys, but I don't really see anything on here yet. So a lot of synthetics, a lot of maybe games we've probably never heard of before other than the Unigine benchmark. But improvements.
It's a good thing.
Yep.
So, and the other thing actually is kind of interesting. Call of Duty Black Ops 2 has live streaming built in on the 360, the PS3, and the PC, but not on the not exactly released yet Wii U. I mean, it's kind of amazing how big a deal live streaming has become for gamers or for some gamers.
Yeah, that's. I mean, I don't know why this doesn't really have a huge thing with hardware necessarily. I just thought it was, I put it in here because it was incredibly interesting. That, you know, we stream gameplay here for things, but we kind of use it as a, hey, let's show what this hardware can do, right? Mm-hmm. And see what kind of settings you can go through and all that kind of stuff. I was always surprised to learn how popular game streaming can be. I mean, you can get 10 and 20,000 people watching StarCraft matches on Twitch.tv or just people playing random games, right? And it's such a big deal now that Black Ops 2, when it comes out, is going to be an incredible seller. I don't know what it's going to surpass, but a lot of things. It will integrate YouTube live streaming right out of the box, like in the game itself, on 360, on PlayStation 3 and PC, right? So apparently you'll just be able to go into the menu, hit a button, you know, log in with your YouTube credentials beforehand and start streaming to YouTube live, which is pretty impressive. And Origin announced the same thing with the partnership through Twitch, where you'll be able to stream your game, whatever game you happen to be playing, directly from the Origin application to Twitch TV. And I think this is going to make, I think it's going to water down a lot of these sites that have game stream stuff, but it will just democratize this whole process, right? Because right now when we do it, we have a separate system to capture it. We're doing all this other kind of stuff. I'll be curious what performance hit this gives, the, you know, takes on systems, but it's interesting. It's interesting stuff. I would not have been one of the people to predict that sitting around and watching people play games would be very popular. I guess
it's all about making games more social.
Yeah, but I mean, I do it. I've done it, and I sat there and watched people play console games on YouTube videos and stuff because they had funny commentary while they're going on and that kind of stuff. So it's just an interesting kind of trend to see.
Speaking of trend, Twitch streaming is also coming to Origin. So it's kind of interesting to watch. I'm not going to repeat what you just said. Streaming video important moving forward.
Yes.
And actually probably coming to the Wii U in the future, depending on what the Wii U's adoption rate is like.
Right.
They'll evaluate that at a later time. We don't talk too much about business news, but I thought this was kind of fascinating. Wanted to bring it up. Foxconn is apparently looking to set up plants in the United States. Foxconn, of course, being the ginormous, like 800,000 million employees, ginormous corporation, the Han High Precision Industry, that is famous for assembling Apple products. So they assemble a whole lot of products other than iPhones and iPads. But apparently their quote says, DigiTimes, conducting evaluations in cities such as Detroit and Los Angeles, according to market watchers. And it's going to be really interesting because they're also speculating that this is going to be for LCD TV production, which can be highly automated rather than the incredibly complicated and painful to produce iPhone 5. So Foxconn's chairman, Terry Guo, at a recent public event, noted that the company is planning a training program for U.S.-based engineers, bringing them to Taiwan or China to take part in the processes of product design and manufacturing. And apparently, they're also working with the Massachusetts Institute of Technology, aka MIT, at sort of a exchange program, bringing engineers over to learn the Chinese language and get a feel for what 21st century production is like in China. So, going to be interesting to see if that turns into anything or not.
I would agree.
And also the CEO of NVIDIA basically says America has discovered that tablets are awesome and they are the future. And buy a Tegra 3 processor.
Way to catch up.
We're going to come back. He's always been about the processors. We're going to come back in a second to talk to you about, email questions. Frankie wants to know about turning off Western Digital's telepark features. We're going to talk about Thunderbolt add-on cards and why we maybe suggest you not use an HDTV as display. But we want to remind you, Twitch, T-W-I-C-H at twit.tv is the email address if you have a question for us or something you want us to check out. And twit.tv/Twitch. It's a place where you can find all of the entire library. The hundreds of episodes of Twitch are archived up there, and you can subscribe and get instructions there. And we want to take a moment to thank our sponsor. This is a very cool piece of hardware. Yes, they are a sponsor. But if you own a printer and you want to print to it from an iOS device, and you notice that the list of iOS printers is ridiculously, painfully, stupidly short, you will love what Lantronics has for you.
Yeah, you know, we actually we got sent one of these, and we were using it for review. And actually, I'm going to go ahead and put a link to the little write up and video we did in the chat room there. But even before I knew they were going to be a sponsor on it, we got this device and I was like, "Oh, let's play around with this." And I came away pretty impressed. So, you know, what's the pitch? What is this device? So if you're at the home of the office printing, if you want to print from your iPhone, your iPad, even your iPod Touch, it's a pain in the butt. Even using AirPrint, which the idea is of AirPrint was great, right? Just kind of this standard for wireless printing and all that kind of deal. AirPrint enabled printers are fairly minimal. Maybe you already have nice printers that you like and you don't want to have to buy new printers. This kind of solves all of that. All those problems, right? XPrint Server enables wireless printing from your iPad, iPhone, or iPod Touch. It eliminates the need to print through apps, install software, or email documents to yourself for printing, which I have been known to do many times. And it works with USB or network attached printers that you already own, if it's wired or wireless or anything like that. I had experience using an HP printer that has what's I think they call theirs ePrint or something like that, where if you wanted to print from your iPad, you couldn't just use the normal browser. You had to open up the HP ad or open up the HP app and then use its browser, which was the same browser. But if you already had your browser and you had a page you wanted to print, but you didn't think about it beforehand, then you had to like copy that URL into the other app and hope that it would load. Or if you were at the end of a form, you were totally screwed in that case. But the Lantronics XPrint server allows you to print directly from iOS native menu. So you just hit the menu button, print, it sees your printer and you go. There's no apps to buy. It supports more than 4,000 top brand network printers. It's easy to use, automatic discovery and setup of printers. That's actually probably one of the coolest parts. You just literally open the box and you plug it into your network. And after about 10, 20, 30 seconds, the light stops blinking. It's found all your printers. You look on your iPhone or your iPad and the printers show up. And it was literally that quick for us. I didn't look at the directions. I just saw, just plug it in and it'll work. I was like, yeah, sure. It actually did do that. It does have advanced configuration, has like a web portal control panel that you can use for that. And one XPrint server supports multiple printers and virtually unlimited iOS devices. The home edition is $99, supports up to 8 USB and 2 network printers. And then the network edition for $149 supports unlimited network printers. It's good for home or office and allows your USB printers to be shared with all users over a network as well. So it kind of acts as a print server for your network as well. So a little bit of a bonus there. Like I said, I actually posted a little bit about that device on PCPro.com, completely unrelated to any of this stuff. But if you go to xprintserver.com/twit, you can get a lot more information about how to buy it. They've got a special offer for you. If you use coupon code TWIT, you'll receive free shipping on your order, I assume of either the home edition or the network edition. So xprintserver.com/twit, and at checkout code, you can use a coupon code. Or at checkout, use coupon code TWIT for free shipping. It was one of those devices where I kind of thought, okay, fine, whatever. But just the simplicity of the setup was astounding to me. So it's got kind of embedded support for these 4,000 printers. You don't like tell it the printers that you have and then it goes and downloads software and it configures them or anything like that. You literally just plug it in. And if you don't want to ever use the control panel, you don't have to use it. And turn on your look at your iPhone, go to your photos, hit the menu button, AirPrint, and our HP LaserJet printer just showed up there, and you could print immediately to it. I mean, the video that I made for it literally happens in real time. There's no editing involved. We have it completely unplugged from the wall. We plug it in and hold the iPad up, and you can see that we print there. I think I print a wonderful image of me somebody took of my golf swing. So, but it's a cool device. It's definitely a cool device. xprintserver.com/twit.
Especially cool if you have their support. Yes. Thank you, Lantronics. We got an email from Frankie about shutting down Western Digital's IntelliPark feature. He writes in, I need to add additional storage to my computer, and I'm thinking about getting a WD Green 2TB WD20 EARX hard drive, or EARX for short. After looking at reviews, I've come to learn this hard drive has a feature called IntelliPark. Basically, it shuts the drive down after being idle for a certain amount of time, between 8 and 300 seconds. There's a program available from Western Digital that can prevent IntelliPark from powering down the drive called WDiddle 3, but it seems to have a questionable history of working properly, at least from what I've read online. I need to get a 2TB hard drive, but I do not want the drive to shut itself down at all, no matter how long it's been idling. I'm tempted to get the WD20 and run WDiddle 3, but I'm also tempted to get a WD Black 2TB and avoid messing with the firmware at all together. What is your view on using WDiddle 3 to disable IntelliPark on a WD Green? Oh my goodness. I think this is a non-issue. I think in feel free to slap me down if I'm wrong. But WDL 3 is more of something you would use, in a server environment, in a RAID environment. Your hard drive, it's okay for your hard drive to park its head.
agree with that. I agree that
hard drives are supposed to be able to park their heads.
Yes, I agree with that. The only problem I have is these series of drives have been known to have a little bit of reliability issue, and has been kind of insinuated. I don't think it's been proven by anybody that it's because of this head park stuff. I haven't seen any of these issues. We use a lot of hard drives here. Alan uses a lot of hard drives, and he's never seen anything like that. I mean, but I also hesitate to say, while it has a funny name, applications that change the firmware of your primary storage device bother me.
Especially ones that date back to 2010.
Okay, yeah. Yeah, I don't have any knowledge of there being anything wrong with the applications like that. I don't want that to come across that way. But when it comes to, you know, your storage, your hard drives, your SSD, I tend to err on the side of caution almost exclusively. And, right, you know, if you want to, you can get the Western Digital Red hard drives, a 2TB drive that will not have that feature or whatever you want to call it. But it is more expensive. Instead of, I'm just looking at Newegg just as a spot check, the 2TB WD Green, the EARX is $109, whereas the WD Red 2TB is $159. So you're basically paying a 50% price premium for the kind of added reliability and stuff of the WD Red drives.
Yeah.
But I mean, it's not that much.
We need to point this out. You know, the only reason there's a very short list of drives you're supposed to use this piece of firmware on. It's not a universal solution. You do not want to run it on non-compatible drives. It's probably going to screw it up.
Yeah.
It's just, you know, going back to error to being profoundly, you know, to being profoundly conservative with this. And I also got to say, this is a problem primarily with RAID arrays. If you have a single 2TB drive in your computer, you do not need to deal with this. Don't. Okay?
Yeah.
You are inventing things. You are inventing excuses to potentially wipe out a perfectly good hard drive. This utility was invented for a certain set of hard drives. You know, basically to control basically manage like load unload cycle issues. Like I'm looking at a Synology webpage and what should I do if my Western Digital Green power disk has a dramatically high load unload cycle count? You know, it looks like actually it's may be applicable from a longer list of drives, but you know, I would try to avoid doing this if you didn't have a reason for it. Man, firmware on drives, if you screw it up, you've got a $150 brick sitting in your hands, and that gets expensive after a while.
And aggravating.
Yeah. So, Sherman has a question about Thunderbolt add-on cards. He says, my main question is that I'd want to add Thunderbolt ports and cables and accessories. When is it cheaper without changing my hardware or main upgrade? I recall a blog article in summer 2012, released in the fall 2012. Is the add-on card out yet? How does it work? Because choosing an Asus P8-877M Pro motherboard. So Asus was going to offer or is offering a Thunderbolt EX add-on card for select Z77 and 877 motherboards. You know, I want to remind you that the add-on card, while inexpensive, is not going to reduce. You know, you're still going to have to spend $50 for each and every Thunderbolt cable you buy. I just want to point that out right now. I love Thunderbolt. Thunderbolt's cool,
right?
But you know, there is no, there's no $5 monoprice Thunderbolt cable. Thunderbolt cable is this enormously smart piece of technology with like 12 chips buried inside of the connectors at either end, and they're selling for like $50 a pop. They're selling for like $50 a pop from Apple. They're selling for like $50-$60 a pop from third party vendors. You know, there's not going to be much in the way of third party Thunderbolt cables until there's a larger kind of market for it. I keep thinking like somebody's going to start making a $25 Thunderbolt cable. And it keeps not happening. Oh, of course, now I'm going to open up a MacLife article. Nope. Western Digital, 2 meter Thunderbolt cable, $49. Elgato, $60. StarTech, $90 because it's a 3 meter cable. So, yeah. I just want to throw that out there.
Okay.
Fair enough. You know, do you like the add-on cards, or would you recommend just going? Because to me, it seems smarter at this point to just, if you have one of those motherboards, great, buy the add-in card if you can find it. But if I was buying a new motherboard today, I would buy one pre-configured with Thunderbolt.
Yeah, you should definitely do that. Yeah, absolutely. Because actually, this person in the email is like, hey, they can't find any. And I've had one for a while, and we did testing with it, and we talked about it. And I was like, surely it was out by now. I went to Newegg, Amazon. You can't buy these cards yet. So I finally went to Asus and I said, what's going on with this? And I sent forwarded them Sherman's email. I said, look, I'm getting these complaints about this kind of stuff. We talked about it a long time ago. And they said, yeah, the problem is actually on Intel side. They've changed the certification process for add-in cards. And so it's delaying things a little bit. I'm worried that what they're changing is if you look at a picture of the Thunderbolt EX card, it actually has a physical DisplayPort cable that goes from the into the Thunderbolt card from the motherboard, right? So this is how it gets the DisplayPort pass through from the integrated graphics, is it physically takes the cable from the external connectors on the motherboard into the card itself. And it's kind of ugly and it's kind of unclean and it's kind of against maybe the mindset of what Thunderbolt is doing or attempting to do. And I'm hoping that they're not trying to change that and then we'll never actually see this card released, because it performs identically to the integrated solution of it in our testing. And you can still do things like display pass-through. You can still daisy chain devices. It worked great in my testing. But I hope I just don't like have the only one.
That would be kind of sad.
Yeah.
But not unprecedented in the world of bleeding edge computer hardware. So seriously, Sherman, get Thunderbolt built into the motherboard if you want it. It's available. Go find it. We have a question from Anonymous. He says, currently I'm using a 27-inch monitor to do my video editing on. Can an HDTV be used as the monitor? My video card is an NVIDIA GeForce 8800 GTS. If the HDTV monitor can be used, what video card would you suggest to get the 1080p resolution? I assume the video card must have an HDMI out. Thanks for the help. I want a larger screen for editing in Lightroom, Photoshop, and Premiere. It's pretty common, like, if you go into an editing station in a professional studio, it's pretty common for the editors to have one or two computer monitors and then a second or third monitor that is an HDTV or an SD display. These days, it's almost entirely HDTV displays. These are color calibrated. They're color corrected. They tend to be, and if the more expensive a facility is, you can easily spend thousands of dollars on this super high-end, you know, extremely tightly calibrated, utterly, you know, to the spec, this is what it's supposed to look like in the perfect viewing environment, television. Here's the problem. Your 27-inch monitor, if it's 1080p, is going to have the exact same resolution as a 34-inch, a 36-inch, a 42-inch HDTV, except the pixels are going to be really big. And that's fine. if you're 8 feet away from the television watching, you know, insert name, you know, The Real Housewives of Orange County. But when
right,
it's
I always do.
Yes. You know, I know you're a big fan.
Oh, yeah.
I'm not, you know, it's. And then there's the whole, the Silicon Valley ones. Pretty funny. I met Hermione Way recently. Lovely woman. I'm a little nervous to see what the Silicon Valley, it's just the Real Housewives of Silicon Valley. Excuse me. The Real Entrepreneurs of Silicon Valley just is pretty funny. We were talking about using HDTVs for monitoring. The problem is though, is when you put a, you know, 34, 42, you know, inch HDTV and use it as your desktop monitor, you have big giant pixels and a lot of light blasting you in the face. Which means you're going to want a second monitor for all of your palettes or all of your additional, you know what I mean? It always sounds like a great idea until you have the giant monitor in front of you and all you can see is, you know, gigantic pixels. at least in my experience, I know a bunch of people who have tried it. A couple of people have stuck with it. Most people have found it incredibly frustrating and gone back to a regular, preferably a high resolution, 27 inch, you know, 24 inch monitor or multiple monitor situation. You know, that said, if all you want is like a bigger screen, so you have a bigger sense of sort of the scale and impact of what you're doing, it may work perfectly for you. You don't need an HDMI output. You can get a DVI to HDMI cable. HDMI output makes it simpler. Am I missing anything?
No, I don't think so.
Sorry. The whole, you know, 1080p is a great resolution at 8 feet. At 3 feet, it really starts to fall apart when you're much above 24 inches.
And it's one of those things that's hard to explain on an audio show or something like that. But once you see it in person, you will immediately know the difference of a 24-inch 1080p screen versus like a 35-inch screen at the same distance from your face.
It's like look at it, like a 24-inch monitor looks great at 3 feet.
Right.
A 42-inch monitor looks like the picture was made out of Legos. I'm exaggerating.
Awesome. Yeah.
It's almost that bad. Should we talk about Xeon ECC memory and water coolers?
We can sort of
related.
Well, the ECC, we'll just do this. We had a question, and this is my fault because I totally spaced on putting the reader's name that submitted these questions, so I apologize. But we had an email from a viewer or listener about Xeon and ECC requirements. He said, do Xeon processors require ECC memory? Everything I am reading says they support ECC RAM, but I can't tell if they support non-ECC RAM. I'm considering basing a home server on an Intel Xeon E3 1265L and an ASRock H77 MVP motherboard, but I don't want to spend the extra money on ECC RAM. Thanks, guys. Love the show. Listen every week, et cetera, et cetera. So I had to look up this processor because I was not familiar with it. The E3 series of processors are low voltage Xeon parts. Where does it list the pricing on there? It's $294. I guess I don't understand. Maybe I'm missing something on why he would want to use a Xeon as opposed to like a Core i5 or a Core i3 part for one of these reasons. Maybe there's a security issue that he's doing on his home server that I don't get. So I'll assume that he needs a Xeon part for it. You do not need ECC memory. ECC memory is supported, not required.
Right.
Go ahead.
Sorry. Oh, it's okay.
I was going to say some motherboard, like when you get into higher end motherboards, server motherboards. I mean, he's talking about an H77 platform. Server motherboards may require ECC. They may require registered memory in order to reach certain memory capacities and this kind of stuff. But for an H77 board using this part, everything I've looked up says no, it does not require ECC memory. So you can save a little bit of dough there.
Yeah. There you have it.
the best site to look at for this, by the way, if you're ever curious about Intel specifications, anything like that on their processors, is arc.intel.com, ARK.intel.com. And you can search for your part there and you'll get, you know, launch dates, core counts, thread counts, clock speeds, cache sizes, memory specs, graphics specs, expansion options, all that kind of stuff in a really, really easy format. And you can compare processors on that too. And I actually will you know, if I'm looking to build a system, I'll put up like all the Ivy Bridge parts on the system and compare and see where these spec differences are exactly. It's a handy site.
Another question we got is, do you see self-contained water cooling for GPUs in the future? Today, to get water cooling from multiple or overclocked GPUs, one would need to put together their own custom-routed water cooling system. These self-contained water coolers are intriguing but do not offer full system cooling. How likely do you believe it will be to see systems like those from Corsair for some of the high-end video card SKUs and the ASRock 877 Pro 4/MVP, but I don't want to spend the money on EEC RAM. So this is going back sort of the second part to the earlier question. Or the mother of all cutting and pasting errors inside of Google Docs, which occasionally we commit. But
one or the other.
I will say, anybody who says that they listen every week and they do it at a slower speed than the rest of their podcast just to enjoy a bit longer, I think we're going to be a little indulgent on the question. But self-contained water-cooled GPUs are a great idea. And I don't think it's ever going to happen until the thermal envelope on GPUs gets so ridiculous that they absolutely positively have to have water cooling to make them function. Because, you know, when you put a GPU in a case, it's pretty simple. You undo a screw, you know, maybe you pull a clip, you pull the card out, you drop the new one on. Maybe there's, you know, obviously you have some power connectors. But routing, water cooling, even a self-contained system like the Corsair stuff requires a lot of additional work. You've got to figure out how to get the water, you know, the tubes full of water outside of the case. You have to place to mount, you know, the fan and the radiator and whether or not there's additional coolant supply there. It's a big pain in the ass. So, you know, in this delirious, you know, parallel universe somewhere off to the side, where, you know, the industry standardized on open sort of, you know, Army Navy style sort of, you know, connect standardized connectors for water cooling so you could mix and match water cooling systems as you upgraded your system over the course of years in this incredible modular universe. It's completely devoid of like patent wars and mayhem. You know, there's probably really awesome GPUs that are being water cooled from the factory. But in this particular universe, It's going to be a niche thing for the most part. I wish it was easier to do and more common, but I don't really see that changing until it gets to the point where you absolutely positively need water to move the heat off of the die. I don't think that's going to happen from any of the major vendors. One, air cooling's gotten too efficient. Two, water cooling, it's a big barrier to entry for somebody to install that in a system case that wasn't set up for water cooling.
PNY released a GTX 580 that had a self-contained water cooling kit with a 120 millimeter radiator on it. But it was a kit you bought altogether, right? It wasn't an add-on part after the fact. Another thing to consider is Intel and AMD force very strict mounting system requirements for heat sinks. There are no such requirements on GPUs, right? Every heat sink and every PCB can be designed differently. And so it would make the idea, I mean, that's why you don't see a lot of water blocks for GPUs either. Or if you do, you see, you know, a water block only works with one particular graphics card or one series of GPUs. It doesn't work with AMD and NVIDIA, or doesn't work with the 7000 and the 6000 and the 5000 series of cards. So it makes, you know, kind of designing coolers that can be used in multiple instances very, very difficult for that industry. And I still don't see that changing anytime soon, because each of these vendors, AMD and NVIDIA, want to be able to change these specs to get slight advantages in noise levels or slight advantages in power consumption at any possible time. So
there you have it. So I got to ask you, that's probably about all we can fit into this particular episode of
Sure.
Twitch, but outside of your big trip to New York and of course Kentucky taking names and kicking ass, what do you see coming up on PCPer.com this week?
We have a couple of new Z77 motherboards coming up. We're getting one in from EVGA. That's a mini ITX board that's squarely aimed at an enthusiast market with a mini ITX platform. That should be cool. I've been doing tons of laptop and mobile and tablet testing. At one point, I kind of wrote like a custom battery script over the last week or so. And at one point, there were 8 devices all running the battery script like on a table. So you could kind of watch them all run in competitions in that way. So expect kind of a summation of Microsoft Surface Asus VivoTab RT, that Yoga 13 that we talked about last week. And I have a Dell system coming in as well. That's a convertible tablet ultrabook device. So a lot of that kind of stuff coming up.
Cool. We did our Yoga 13 review on Techzilla this week. We have Sharon Backnin, a pretty awesome how-to expert from over at CNET, showed us how to add USB ports and USB devices to your Android phones and tablets, which I thought was pretty fascinating. And Lori Grunin is going to be on next week with her camera picks as we build up towards the holiday shopping season of doom. And hopefully, if everything works out, Sasha Sagan from PC Mag, who's headquartered out of New York, will be on to catch us up with some of the latest phone releases, because it's just been a ridiculous, you know, we pretty much everybody knows what's going on with the iPad mini and the Microsoft Surface and the Nexus 7. And we want to get caught up with the flood of phones, especially the new Windows phones that are coming out. Exciting times in mobile. And also going to give a shout out to our sponsor, Ting. I did get my Ting router. It's pretty cool actually. And my first bill was for $6.
I'm very sad.
$60 I would have paid on my previous smartphone.
My bills are not $6.
No. My AT&T phone bill is considerably higher than that. But nice. Weiwei mobile hotspot is actually pretty much more thrifty with the battery than I expected based on my overdrive experience, 4G cool. overdrive experience. And so it's been exciting. And $6, baby. $6. That's a phone bill I can deal with, or a data plan bill.
Agreed.
AT&T, are you listening? In any case, that's about it for this edition of Twitch. This week, Computer Hardware. I'm Patrick Norton.
I'm Ryan Trout.
We'll see you next week on Twitch.